Hot Air is a co-production of American University Washington College of Law and the American Bar Association. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
From the campus of American University in Washington, D.C., a collaboration between the American University's Washington College of Law and the American Bar Association's newly renamed Energy, Environment, Markets, and Finance Committee. This is the Hot Air Show, your resource for debate and insight on carbon policy, politics, and markets. I'm your host, Chris Barron. In this show, we will be discussing what happened down in Mexico in the sun, what was the results of Cancun, what do they mean going forward, and we'll also be touching a bit on EPA's latest release of the best of achievable control technology guidance for greenhouse gases in the PSD entitled Seven permitting programs. Excuse me, Title V permitting programs. It's early here. We got started early. And with that, on this snowy day in D.C., I'll let my panelists introduce themselves.
Hi, I'm Lisa Zelliot. I work for Point Carbon, a Thomson Reuters company, and we analyze carbon markets and deal with emissions trading.
Bill Snape, Senior Counsel, Center for Biological Diversity, and a practitioner in residence here at the Washington College of Law.
Kevin Book, Clearview Energy Partners, Research Energy and Environmental Policy Trends, and how they change supply, demand, and price.
And these were the individuals who were intrepid enough to make it through the snow. Well, we had an unexpected result from a lot of people's minds in Cancun, especially after what had happened in Copenhagen. There were agreements that came out, and a general feeling of goodwill. Lisa, you were one of the few of us who actually made it down there, and I hear we're, unlike the U.S. delegation, allowed on the beach. And so maybe you can touch a little bit on what were the components that made a Cancun a success. Was it expectations management? Was it the process? What were your thoughts for why people felt good coming out of Mexico?
I think both of those things. Expectation management, for one, because everyone was so burned from Copenhagen and having experienced this process that was sort of a lack of a process there, so they didn't have much hope for what was going on in Cancun. And then also the process itself and how it was run by the Mexican presidency. It was, in the first week, it was not very clear that things were going to go in a positive direction, because the Mexican presidency tried painstakingly to be extremely transparent and inclusive and let every party render a verdict on every single decision, and it was quite tedious seeming. But then that really paid off in the second week at the ministerial level, when everybody had been able to actually participate. And you saw that in the closing plenary. The vibe just totally changed. It was great to be there, because almost every single party that was, you know, had the lead negotiator making a statement towards the end, where the adoption of the text was going to take place, just lavished praise upon the Mexican presidency and how they ran the show. They really said, you know, everybody had a chance to participate, everybody had a chance to make a comment, and nobody was 100% happy with the texts that were going to be adopted, but nevertheless they called for adoption. And it was strategically well run by the Mexican presidency. And they did do a lot of pre-COP work. For instance, they held a meeting of ministers before the COP even happened. So a lot of the ideas that were going to be presented in the second week were already sort of on people's minds before they even went into the negotiations. That was a very smart move. That's where we saw the Indian proposal on MRV come up. That was then later, a version of that was actually what was adopted in the final text. So I think running the COP in that transparent way was a really smart move, and also brought everybody back together and sort of restored the faith in the UN process, which is, I would say, half of the deal that was reached. I mean, a lot of the actual conclusions were not very definitive, and they mostly set up, you know, new work programs, new institutions, and new processes. But this restored faith in the UN process going forward is going to be very useful in Durban when it comes to actually making some kind of a deal.
There was a point of inflection, too, wasn't there? I mean, in the first week, Japan kind of dug in. It seemed like things were not going as smoothly. The gears were churning pretty slowly. What really was the moment of inflection in your mind where the tide changed and things started to move towards consensus?
I think when they got to the ministerial level, so around December 7th, 8th, right before things built up to the final adoption of the text, because then it became clear that all of this transparency had really paid off and every party had been informed of the process. Back to Japan's act at the beginning of just stating right away, look, guys, we're not for a second commitment period of the Kyoto Protocol. In my opinion, that was a really good move to just get that out there on the floor before in the beginning of the negotiations, because it clearly put down the lines between developing countries and the industrialized world, and they've been at odds over this, but kind of not really stating it. Europeans have said, you know, we're technically for a second commitment period, but only if AAUs don't carry over, and all of this really just got laid out there, and everybody knew going into Cancun that that was not going to be one of the subjects of the outcome, and that it was going to be punted to Durban right from the start. So Japan saying that right from the beginning just sort of laid things out there and made it clear that discussion needed to happen and process and progress needed to happen on the other subjects at hand.
Interesting. Now, the agreements that came out of Cancun, while it moved the ball on a number of fronts, in terms of any type of binding targets, holding folks to the commitments made in Copenhagen, and so on, not much on that front. And in fact, you've heard some folks in the carbon community globally say, you know, this was a success because it absolutely had to be to kind of keep everyone on the train moving forward, you know, at least looking ahead to Durban. And that actual substantive progress was sparse in the text when it comes to a binding target. Now, Bill, from your perspective, you know, is that something that was smart to have punted to Durban? What are your thoughts in terms of how high they should have reached at coming out of Cancun? Did they reach high enough from your perspective?
No, they absolutely did not reach high enough. In fact, I don't think they really reached at all. And let me just say that I agree with everything Lisa just said. I think within the context of the UN process, it's hard to dispute her conclusions. But one analyst has said that while Cancun may have saved the United Nations process, it may be the death knell for the climate convention itself. And I think there's a lot of truth to that.
Now, is that the framework convention or is that the Kyoto Protocol?
Certainly the Kyoto Protocol is on the ropes. And I think the whole notion of what the convention is going to achieve and whether we're going to have science-based reduction targets, mandatory science-based reduction targets, is obviously very much in question. I think the United States is the lead cheerleader for these voluntary agreements. I think the United States domestically is showing that it is very scared to do anything that actually reduces the carbon footprint. And so I think one of the reasons why there is this sort of glow post-Cancun is because expectations were so low, and then, you know, a toddler could have leaped to that hurdle. So we can get more into the details, but I definitely view the glass as half empty. I'm very disappointed in the U.S. behavior, and very disappointed that as we head into next year, yes, we've got this architecture and we have these good-sounding words, but we are no closer to actually solving the problem than we were 1 year ago, 2 years ago, or 5 years ago.
Kevin, they touched on expectations management, and that, you know, as Bill put it, a toddler could have jumped over that hurdle. Now, here in the United States, in terms of, you know, the political media and what's been drawing Congress's and other folks' attention, one can understand why the expectations game wasn't too heightened for Cancun, because you really didn't hear much about it here in the mainstream media or for the United States. The same types of delegations that you saw going to Copenhagen, the umph that went into Copenhagen, that was just you know not present here for Copenhagen. Now, do you think that that was all part of the expectation management game here from a political standpoint? If we did reach higher, as Bill, you know, says that we really needed to, would that have been palatable in this environment right now?
Well, I think it's a weird world, Chris, when you have TV coverage of Copenhagen, Denmark, and you don't have cameras in Cancun. It says an awful lot about what the underlying process must be worth if bathing suits took second billing to fur hats. But the bottom line on all of this stuff is that there is a redefinition of timescale that happened. After a market crash, there's a workout. We hit a period of extremely exuberant, if not irrational, exuberance in our expectations for Copenhagen, and it bottomed. What has happened now is no longer thought of as a 1 or 2 year process, with the logical conclusion being a second commitment period. that it's not just Japan. I mean, private stakeholders here in the U.S., folks like Eileen Clausen at Pew, have said, no, we don't think there's going to be one of these transnational cap-and-trade solutions. That's not what it's going to be. It's going to be a grind. It's going to be a grind. And at this point, what we've done is we've begun the grind. And unfortunately, that sort of bureaucratic, multinational grinding, the way treaties do get actually worked out, it's almost tectonic in the way that it moves. Suddenly, there's a treaty, and everyone goes, how did that happen? It's because the final centimeter or millimeter has been crossed. But the slow progress to that, the building of this framework, is the essential first step. Does it look sexy? No. Does it have the imminence or the immediacy of Copenhagen? No. And it brings up, I think, an important question for the U.S. politics, which is, if we can blow it off because it doesn't become tomorrow's issue immediately in the next election cycle, how much are we going to be stakeholders to it when it does matter 5 years out?
It's an interesting point. You could ask, is this that much different from where we are on other fronts of globalization in terms of
Doha
and the rounds and where we are in terms of our agricultural aspects to trade and so on. It's are we dealing with an artifact of just the global reality, the postmodern age here?
I mean, I think where we are globally is that we're in a recession globally, and markets need to clear before they can function. Global trade is stagnant, and this is part and parcel of the global trade that we need to resume for economic expansion to benefit the OECD. What has to happen isn't just that we need to price our houses down and clear markets here. We need to price our expectations for this compromise down. We need to be willing to discard some of the value that has been built in the OECD and accept the developing world's propositions and let the market clear at a different price to get that market working. If I'm mixing metaphors too much, I mean, basically there is no pressure on trade yet. We're not at a point where carbon is trade like it was in 2008 or 2007. And we'll get back to that point, and it won't be us on the winning side of it if we don't jump in. I think that'll get attention going again.
Can I make 2 points, Chris? I agree with how Kevin is setting this up, but let me offer one point that seems completely disassociated with what we're talking about and then link it to the trade agreements that Kevin was just talking about. First of all, in terms of the recession, and I think this is akin to the power that the fossil fuel industry continues to have over the world, this is a recession caused by widespread banking corruption. I mean, let's call a spade a spade. We have pumped in trillions of dollars to bail out speculative, derivative transactions that have brought the entire world to its knees. And when you transfer that to the global warming battle, I think you have governments that are still captive to the old school industries of fossil fuels. That may be good, it may be bad. I happen to think it's bad, but it is. And maybe we can talk about that real politic as we proceed. But on the second point I want to make on the trade, perhaps the more constructive point as it relates to what we're trying to accomplish here this morning, trade agreements historically have always been built by a series of bilateral and narrower multilaterals that then become consensus-based, and the multilaterals, while you have to work hard to get them, sort of present themselves because of the underlying agreements that become a part of the global agreement. All of the Uruguay round, which of course created the World Trade Organization, was because you had NAFTA, you had some of the South American countries, you had Europe all coming together, and there were some principles that could then be put on the world table for a multilateral agreement. One of the things that I've been very frustrated by with the United States is that the United States could be more aggressive in these bilaterals and multilaterals that would help with a truly global scale climate convention. But the United States is not interested. The United States has the authority. The United States certainly has the political power. But in the United States, and including this administration, which I would argue on climate is really not that much different globally than was the Bush administration, they are not interested in anything binding. They are only interested in these sort of hand-holding, feel-good, put some words on a paper type operations. And I think that really is the problem. So I think the trade agreement is a good analogy to why it is we're not going anywhere globally at this point. Maybe this will change in a year, but I'm not seeing it right now.
Well, I was going to say two interesting points, because I want to ask this question to you, Lisa, here. You know, we talked about the workout in the recession, and we talked about multilateralism, and, you know, it's a perpetual Achilles heel in terms of a global governance structure, someone to exert force of will over nations, and so on. The UN you know, I don't think anyone's going to think it serves that role fully, maybe partially in certain aspects. But this drives into the concept of actually being able to hold people to when they say, I'm going to make this reduction of this much, that I'm going to allow you to, you know, demonstrate to audit that I've actually done it. Monitoring, reporting, verification aspects of the climate debate. Now, part of a workout in a recession is having a clear evaluation of what your actual assets look like. And part of multilateralism is, again, having that compliance and enforcement. Another tie-in just to this last discussion when I throw this to you, Lisa, is, you know, Bill, you sounded just a little bit like some of the quotes I heard out of the Bolivian delegation on some of the red issues about how we don't want Wall Street bankers, other folks, looking at this issue. Now, you know, from my perspective, you know, when there's a huge economic downturn, it's easy to color every type of derivative like a credit default swap. But there's certainly when it comes to the energy environmental markets, there's a host of applications for derivatives that it would take too long in this discussion to go into their value. But all of this discussion really drives, I think, towards not only the why we're having trouble getting binding targets out there, but also how do we monitor, report, verify what we do agree to do, or even be able to set our baselines going forward. Now, you had mentioned, Lisa, India kind of served as a bridge on this issue. Maybe talk a little bit about that. How did India get folks who, you know, wanted to participate but didn't want to give up what they saw as too much aspects of their sovereignty when it comes to emissions? How was that issue bridged?
Very good point, and it derives from the point that you made before, Bill, about moving toward away from the sort of binding target approach and more towards a group of bilateral agreements that then perhaps in the future will culminate in some sort of overriding principle agreement. And I think it's worth making the point just before I get into MRV, not that I'm, you know, defending the administration, but it was definitely evident that the negotiators on behalf of the Obama administration, their hands were tied. They had nothing to bring to the table. And I heard from several delegations out there that aren't aware necessarily of the U.S. political system, surprise at that it requires two-thirds of the Senate to ratify an international treaty. Everyone says, you know, well, our government took on Kyoto. What's the big deal here? So I think the issue of how governments work and how the U.S. Has a tough time actually adopting a treaty is not in defense of the administration necessarily, but that definitely came into play. And you saw that with the discussions about finance as well. The U.S. Delegation made a huge effort to explain exactly where the finance that is budgeted in the current, that has made it through the 2010 fiscal year, is going, and which countries it's going to help, et cetera. And then there were tons of questions about next year's, and what were they able to say? The appropriations just hasn't passed yet. So just to bring it back to the MRV discussion, it's sort of along the same lines. The money that is going to be spent on mitigation and adaptation in developing countries from an industrialized country's point of view, it needs to be monitored. There has to be some sort of assessment for the taxpayers whose money that is, where it's going, what kind of processes and mitigation efforts it's actually going to fund, lest it go into the pockets of corrupt leaders in some of those countries. On the other side, it's experienced as a breach of sovereignty to have a country or some kind of international panel sort of snooping in your business to see what you're doing with the money. So the Indian proposal actually tried to sort of mitigate with these two sides. And the discussion was about if the money comes from international sources, that needs to be monitored and should be monitored through an international body, whereas if it's a domestically funded climate mitigation effort, then it can be monitored on a domestic level and simply reported. So the fine lines between those units of monitoring, whether the international body or domestically, there was a lot of sort of nuanced wording in the text that finally got adopted that made it acceptable to all of the parties. And so the Indian proposal had this international consultation and analysis board, a sort of group of experts. And so developing countries are expected now in the new text to actually report on their mitigation actions every 2 years. They submit an inventory inventory anyway. And then in addition to that, they give update reports that talk about not only their emissions profile, in other words, where emissions are coming from in their country, but also the mitigation actions that they're taking. And those, if they are funded internationally, actually need to be looked at by this independent board. And one of the key aspects of the independent board is that its results are not punitive. They cannot be used to actually punish the country if it hasn't achieve the mitigation targets, but the idea is a sort of name and shame, expose and pledge and review from the outside. It will be very evident if the money is not going to the right place because this expert panel has reviewed it. And in reverse, the demand from the developing countries was, if you're going to MRV our mitigation actions, we would like to MRV the source of the finance. Here you are promising us all this money. We have no measurement, reporting, and verification of where the financing is coming from. And that's a legitimate concern from their side. So in this constant industrialized developing country divide that sort of permeates the discussion already since for years, this was really kind of a breakthrough to get this agreement on at least a level of nuanced wording in the text. Now, how it's going to proceed and how they're going to create this ICA and how all of the actual evaluation is going to take place has yet to be seen, but at least it's been enshrined in the text.
Kevin, does any of that Lisa just covered around, you know, transparency, you know, auditing, monitoring, verification about these types of outlays of international funds to the developing world, does that help at all here in the political environment in terms of getting these funds approved? I guess the question is, you know, as austerity falls across this country and has fallen elsewhere, is what happened in Cancun just talk? Is the money going to show up?
It's just talk, especially now. One of the problems with the carbon security is that it doesn't have intrinsic value unless it's backed by an actual store of value. One of the reasons why you let the devil into your house, if you're going to make a deal like Carrie Lieberman, or for that matter, like some of the provisions of the original Kyoto Protocol, is so that you can have something to collateralize the store of value. The real problem when you have an international transfer payment, particularly one coupled to something as mercurial and change prone, especially as the United States' annual budgeting process, is that you need to have some sort of anchor. The idea of an independent trust fund is always preferable. The idea of a currency minted in a central place and traded internationally is always preferable. And we're forced now to decouple into the bilateral miasma that we're in right now and start having these trust exercises show up. I think it's going to be very hard for OECD countries to bring the trust up to a level that the developing nations are going to be excited about, because they're not in control. And there's a number of developments. If you just look across the world and you say, what's going on, take it beyond climate to the green space. Equity subsidy fatigue has permeated the entire OECD. We're sick of giving out free money because it works. But we're especially sick of it because we're giving it to foreign investors in almost every country, whether it be Germany, Spain, Italy, the United States. The solar industry just recently said to it, look, we're actually a solar exporter. Don't stop giving us money. And Congress this morning passed a bill that won't give them 48C credits. And so that's that. We're not patient with the process that has to prime a pump for a market to begin to mint a currency. And we're particularly uncomfortable in the CDM, for that matter, especially in the derivatives markets of yesteryear, with the idea that there's someone originating something that we can't see. So the Mervyn trust game, if anything, we almost certainly will come back with a deficit relative to what the developing world wants to see on the trust side, and they are implicitly in deficit relative to the standards and expectations of folks like Bill who want transparency.
Just on that, and it's interesting that you bring it up, this idea of transparency, if it could possibly take care of itself in some way if you put a value on the asset. One of the other things that came out of the text is the creation of this registry. And we were talking earlier before the show started about calling it Craigslist, because that's kind of what it is. Developing countries will post a mitigation action that they seek funding for, and developed countries will post some amount of money that they seek a mitigation action for. And the idea is that these would find each other and sort of pair, and it kind of goes along with the way Bill was describing the process from now on, that it's turning into a set of bilateral agreements and nothing really top down, sort of bottom up working each other out in the form of smaller deals. But I'm wondering if this registry idea could actually solve some of the MRV issues and prevent them from having to be created top down. Because if you're on Craigslist and you're looking at, you know, something that you want to invest in, you're going to make sure that it has the best MRV before you put your money into it. So it sort of takes care of itself in that way. And same in the reverse, if you're proposing your mitigation action and trying to receive money for it, perhaps you're going to check that that money is really there. And so there wouldn't have to be some kind of outside panel to do this.
Wait, I just thought of what you just said. So if you have a transaction mediated on a bulletin board, on a Craigslist-like bulletin board, and you have people who are both susceptible to default risk on either side of the transaction, there's almost certainly a need for a third party who's willing to capitalize an insurance policy. And that would be, we wouldn't call it a credit default swap exactly, but it would probably be in the interest of both parties who are in the somewhat fiscally fragile trust exercise to be able to buy a small basis point, you know, percentage insurance policy. Wow, yeah. I think we need the derivatives bill.
Yeah. Well, let me make a macro point. I actually do not disagree with what I've just heard. I mean, I do think that while I have a lot of concerns about the transparency and about the legitimacy of it, I do believe that this type of action is positive because it's better than nothing. But I want to make the very basic command and control point. I guess that's why I'm here, that if you set those science-based standards on the reduction limits, that all of these financing issues and all of the incentive to want to make it work sort of take care of themselves. What's happening now is there's no incentive to change the way business is working right now. I'm talking at the macro level. Obviously, there are some powerful microeconomic forces that where you do see some success stories. But from the United States, you know, which is the big giant on the world stage, along with China and other countries, but particularly the United States, we're the United States to actually commit, which I know is a political leap at this point, but commit to science-based reduction standards, these types of incentives for renewables, these types of incentives for clean energy would take care of themselves. They'd have no choice. So I keep making that point, and I was being a little bit self-deprecating and talking about it as command and control, which it is, but I think the command and control, when you looked at it historically, does spawn that type of innovation. I wanted to respond earlier to something Lisa said about what the United States brought to the table, because you were right on a certain level, there was a major point that you were missing, and that is in trade agreements. The World Trade Organization, as a prime example, the Senate never voted on the World Trade Organization as a treaty. It voted on it as an executive agreement and as implementing legislation for which the House only needed to have 50.1% and the Senate, with the filibuster rule, 60 votes. So we're not talking about 67 votes, and we're talking about the fact that the Clean Air Act, particularly Section 115, already gives the president and the administrator authority to negotiate these deals. So the reality was and is that the United States chose not to bring anything to the table. This is part of this little shuck and jive that they are playing right now and saying, oh, well, Congress hasn't acted, therefore, you know, we're just going to talk a little bit more. And they are not grabbing the bull by the horns. And we all know that if the United States came to the table and said, we are going to propose science-based reduction standards, Japan, South Africa, Russia, maybe, certainly the European Union, many of these countries would follow. Japan certainly would.
Japan's already there, 25% below 1990.
But Japan doesn't want to go to the next stage of the Kyoto Protocol precisely because no one else is with them. So I think the United States really is still in the center of this, and the United States continues to not show leadership, quite bluntly.
But the Kyoto Protocol is not an executive agreement. It is a treaty. And it was not brought for ratification because it is a treaty. I mean, I buy the Nigel Purvis authored this whole thing about that we should recharacterize it as an executive agreement. Maybe that's on the table, but I think that's for a different discussion, because the Kyoto Protocol second commitment period would be a second commitment of the existing Kyoto Protocol. So you'd really have to change the nature of the deal in order for the U.S. to adopt it, which I think perhaps that's what they're trying to do. I mean, the Copenhagen targets that were later submitted in the form of this sort of document that came after Copenhagen through January and February in 2010 have now actually been linked to the text that was adopted in Cancun. So that's a huge step forward from the U.S. perspective, because actually that which they brought forward, the Copenhagen Accord, which was merely taken note of and therefore has no particular legal status, is now actually being incorporated into the U.N. system. So that's the basis on which they're going to be moving forward in Durban.
Are we going to have to go through a reframing process? I mean, historically, Kyoto has been treated as a treaty. That's how it's been thought about. That's how it's been voted on. That's how, you know, back even from the SRES 98 days, which was less of a vote on Kyoto, more of guidance to negotiators. But the which had ultimately the same practical effect.
95 very strong no's.
Exactly. But the question is, you know, even is part of this process trying to reframe just simply around the politics of old, so that people can bring something new and fresh, whether it's here or in Brussels or elsewhere, to say, look, we've thought through this and we've gotten rid of the baggage of old. We're moving through. And what does that do for things like the clean development mechanism, for flexibility mechanisms within Kyoto that traditionally have had a lot of project finance drive through them? Now we have the bulletin board. You know, our carbon finance social network, you know, government to government. You know, we saw, you know, with JI and other aspects that sometimes government to government can take a little bit longer than if you have a centralized body establishing standards, directing, you know, that finance can then flow through. All of your points about securitizing carbon assets, certainly valid. That's a nifty endeavor to try to securitize an interest around carbon credits, or let alone attach a security interest. But, you know, are we in that process where we're simply just trying to, for the point of making a new, refreshing the frameworks here? Is that what's happening?
Let me start, since I think I'll be at the bottom of the pile on here, and I'll just start off, which is one heretical thing I'll say. Many of my environmental colleagues will grimace, but I think Kyoto really is problematic. It has become a symbol, correctly or wrongly, fairly or not, of something that, at least in the United States, is just not politically viable. I recognize that. So I actually, my response to you, Lisa, I was nodding my head. listeners couldn't see that. But no, I think that we do need something new, Chris. And whether it's very much like Kyoto, but we call it something not Kyoto, doesn't matter. It needs to be repackaged. The other point I want to make, which I think gets into the clean development mechanism in red, which we haven't talked much about, is, I mean, from my vantage point, those are fudge devices. Those are devices by which this very difficult task of really, literally reducing emissions, which obviously most countries are terrified of because no one's really doing it, gives some flexibility and opportunity to perhaps do good things. I'm not that cynical, half cynical, not that cynical. But let's face it, RED and the CDM and all these types of offset projects, they're not enforceable. There's huge baseline issues. There's even if you committed to transparency, they are impossible, really, to track in an objective, comprehensive way. So I think we ought to just recognize that these are mechanisms created to let the pressure off, you know, let the air out of the very heavily inflated tire for countries that are having very difficult times making emission promises and holding their word to it. And until we recognize that's what it really is, we're going to get into all these sort of academic, oh, well, if we do this to red and if we do this, it will really... No, it's always going to have a degree of fudge factor, in my view. I don't know how you avoid it.
Are you coloring it too generally, though? I mean, it's a pretty powerful statement, Bill. That's why we have Bill on the show. But, I mean, are you coloring it too generally? I mean, give you an example. There have been companies, AgSort, for example, that, you know... basically went out there, did good projects, methane gas projects, agricultural gas projects, and it was because of the stringency of the baseline establishment, the monitoring, verification, and so on of the projects out there that they ended up with significantly less issuance than they thought. And you know, the good folks in that company have found other homes throughout the industry. But you know, are you looking at a few of the examples? Because I think there are a number of ones that demonstrate that it can be done and it can make real differences. It's not all HFC 23, HFC 22 issues, which actually was one of the things that really stood out to me when looking at the reporting of Cancun. You know, Lisa, did I read right when they were talking about folks in members of the Chinese delegation basically threatening to vent HFC 22? HFC 23 out to the atmosphere, vent the HFC 23 instead of incinerating it. You know, that may have been something that muttered in a moment of anger, but you know, it seemed like people were really, really worked up on that issue. understandably. What was your perspective on that?
I was not in the negotiation where anyone threatened to vent HSC, but I was in a bus on the way back to the hotel after the conference center, and there were some members of a Chinese, it was a China Carbon Fund, so they were technically an NGO, but they're part of the finance ministry, I guess. And they were making the case for HFC and the research on the perhaps not additionalness of the HFC projects perhaps being false, because there are, they were bringing lots of arguments about how it's actually under the Montreal Protocol not regulated as a feedstock, and there's extensive feedstock use, for instance, for making mm-hmm. Teflon and HFC. So they were bringing all these points that I personally haven't gotten into the issue that much, but there was a lot of discussion about HFCs in general and their importance. But in the wider discussion about the CDM and going forward with it, Point Carbon's research, we have this enormous database of all CDM projects, and we track them from their when they're just a project idea note all the way through, and a lot of project developers use this product. They would be appalled to hear that it's all being called intransparent, and it takes a year and a half to 2 years to get a project through the cycle, which is very rigorous. But I agree that it is complicated for the very reason that they're trying to keep the rigor, and that does not allow it to actually produce large volumes of reductions, because it's on a project-by-project basis. It depends on what you consider large volumes, and so the CDM as a whole is projected to decrease emissions below what they would have otherwise been by at least 1.2 gigatons, which is nothing to sneeze at. But in terms of the future of the CDM and the reforms that were made in Cancun, one of the big issues was this idea of standardized baselines to try to sort of grease the skids for getting projects through faster, the idea that you would have some sort of standardization on the baseline from which the reductions are measured, and therefore you could get projects through faster. Perhaps it wouldn't take a year and a half to 2 years for each project. So the idea is to keep it going forward, but the overall question is what happens to the CDM in the case that there is no Kyoto Protocol second period, and there was a lot of debate on this. Our view is that it will continue, because unless parties specifically disband the Kyoto Protocol and therefore the flexible mechanisms associated with it, the CDM will not go away. And the CDM is a mechanism to allow Annex 1 countries to meet their mitigation targets. That's what it says in the text. So as long as they have targets and as long as they can meet them, and no party registered any sort of complaint against the CDM or said that it should be discontinued.
Yeah. There's been some talk about taking it up as a project through another UN agency if need be, that was outside the framework convention, I've heard. And maybe Europe could keep it running. Other folks could keep it running as needed. But it seems like, at least for now, folks are interested in addition to the CDM, other techniques like the bulletin board, Craigslist financing concept. Now, I mean, part of the argument behind you were making, Bill, behind these flexibility mechanisms is that they really are an inefficient way compared to command and control.
Before we have the complete pile on, that is not what I said.
Okay, I put words in your mouth.
Yeah, yeah, and you also asked me a rhetorical question. I didn't get to answer it. Kevin will get the final knockout blow here, but perhaps I'll say something for which he will at least half agree, which is I didn't say that this was a horrible thing. I recognize there are some good projects, perhaps even the majority. I don't know. I would doubt it, but there are certainly projects that are, when you look at them in retrospect, not really constructive, not really what the agreements had in mind. But again, the fact that some of these things are happening and that they are reducing emissions and that they are absorbing carbon or dealing with methane, I think is good. I think in the water world in the Southwest with dams and rivers, there's a saying by water operators that wet and sloppy is good. And when you start damming and having concrete liners and you start following every little molecule of water, that's when real abuse occurs. And I think in CDM, wet and sloppy is good. There's going to be some good projects. There's going to be some bad projects. I'm okay with that as long as there is an umbrella of command and control, and that we know where we're going, and that there's an actual end target to this, not just sort of these deals for deal's sake. Mm-hmm. And on methane and natural gas, or methane, you didn't mention natural gas, I'm about to, I have no doubt. I'm not familiar with those projects, but I have no doubt that with regard to reducing methane emissions from either landfills or agricultural operations or what have you, where there is some natural gas conversion opportunities, the reason why those are occurring, and I think they are good, is because they are lucrative, because it actually makes sense. So that's what the whole methane to markets program worldwide is all about. So again, I'm not saying it's all bad. It just has to be within a context of a command control bottom line goal that we are achieving. That's the point I was trying to make.
I think I want to move your command and control context to the sideline as a ref. Let me start with a couple of things you said, Bill, because I don't happily defend markets, right? It's, you know, those I guard I do not love, those I fight I do not hate, to quote Yeats. It's not exactly as though I believe purely in an unregulated market. I think actually the model we've learned we need is a free market with an exceedingly tough regulator. And if you put all of the work into the origination, then the verification and the redemption stages of the value chain cost you less, and the market works better. The problem is that the originators run the markets most of the time, and they define the origination standards, and they self-regulate. In this particular context, you have a multilateral body that sits outside of governments. The two reasons why I think you want to keep it and cling to it, I agree, the historical record shows that flexibility was added as a way to seal the deal. It wasn't the core of the thing. And the fact that all these scabby bankers have made it the core of the thing is repulsive to true environmentalists. I understand. But the reason why command and control can't work, in spite of the fact that this little deal-clinching UNFCCC Kyoto banker-loving plan got added, it can be the core of the solution because G2G doesn't work on Mervyn. You can't cross, governments can't cross national barriers as well as dollars. And the good thing about private capital is that it has a license to follow up and value itself. And if you let the dollars do the crossing instead of the governments, you don't have wars as much. Also, you have a trend line. You do have a trend line. You can have a trend line because without the trend line, the capital doesn't come to the market. What the market does is it phases investment so that the scatter plot couples closer to the trend. The way it works right now is that you have to swallow a lot of these HFC deals where you say, were they created just to be turned off, born to be killed? Were these the veal calves of the carbon reductions? I don't know that you can say no to them because they collateralized a market for which there are those legitimate projects. What you've said is what I think everyone knows. Intrinsic value endures when the crap goes away. Okay, the first phase got the market going. Don't kill it now. You get a tighter scatter plot, an agent that can cross boundaries a lot more easily than governments can, and if you keep the regulator honest and make it faster too, you probably end up with something that actually brings people to the market because the value endures.
Just to support your point, we have some empirical data that actually shows that these HFC and industrial gas type projects were really the low-hanging fruit, and there's only so many of them that can be picked, and they're starting to be picked because we're seeing in our data the type of project that project developers are turning to now are increasingly the renewables, the energy efficiency, the arguably more sustainable types because the low-hanging fruit isn't there anymore to be invested in. So just to keep going.
Well, and I agree with this. The problem is with the term command and control, which, of course, in the United States regulatory circles has a very definitive, frequently negative connotation. But let me tell you what I mean by command and control and to add some sideboards to what I hear you saying. I would like to command science-based targets. I would like to control pollution levels. And in so doing, the process would lead to incentivizing truly clean energy projects. And I don't think the three of us are disagreeing with that.
No, but you can't have that. You can only have command and control when you actually have control. Your command can be over those science-based targets as represented by securities that you can control. You can't control other governments unless you're going to put some military muscle behind it. I'd rather put gold instead of guns behind my commands and my controls.
You very well might be right as a matter of real politics, but what you are saying is that we will never have binding reduction targets in an international accord. Because that's the control I'm talking about. The control would derive from, no pun intended, the actual text of a treaty or an executive agreement. That's the control. The countries would be committing to that.
We have capital reserve requirements under Basel II. We have plenty of things that are binding that we agree to that mediate markets. If we don't have those things, then international trade standards for currency fall apart. And we have them because we need them. We accept them because our regulators at a national level, EPA would be delighted to have a standardized carbon security that it could look to as a compliance mechanism under, you know, whether it's a 111D solution or whatever law gets cobbled together, tradable carbon performance standard of next year. But whatever it is, the idea isn't necessarily to repudiate this firm regulation and this decisive grip on a reduction. It's to get the people who have incentives to support it, not to impose it on them.
In other words, capital follows capital, and so on. I mean, it's fascinating. Anytime you have a discussion with as smart a group as this about an international issue and the question of global governments comes into effect. I've been in a few discussions that doesn't ultimately get to this point about who's going to enforce everyone at the national at the international level.
Carbon police.
And the carbon police, because everyone, it's a great image, I'm sure, for some of the more conservative sides of the debate, to see a bunch of guys run up with a badge and a big green leaf on their chest, saying, "Hey, I'm the carbon police. You better watch it." But we do have mechanisms through the international trade frameworks, albeit there's a big question mark that a lot of folks have as to how you might be able to use tariffs and other types of mechanisms to enforce this kind of thing. But I guess the question is, this is a real polity constant for humanity. We're never going to get beyond it. And so looking ahead, is it natural that we're falling into this kind of let a thousand flowers bloom type of approach? I mean, if there's anything that I'm taking out of Cancun, it's that we all still want to do something. We can't agree what the grand frame of it, the grand scheme of it is. And instead, we're going to try to do as many little good things as we can all think about in the meantime.
Chris, there's an international law concept, though, that I think Kevin is glossing over or doesn't believe in. No, come back at me on, I guess you really do believe in the market more than you think, but under the World Trade Organization, Montreal Protocol, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, and probably others, but those three immediately leap into my mind. Right. Commitments are made in the text of the treaty, and the countries enforce them against each other.
Under Article 20B and G of GATT, treatment, yes, I agree.
That is what occurs.
Concepts.
And so therefore, whether you agree it's a good idea or a bad idea, whether it will happen or not happen, what I'm saying is, a matter of international law, there's nothing preventing that from happening. There's no international carbon police. Countries will police each other based upon the commitments they make. That is the control part of this command and control.
The police have leverage over the policed. The problem is, Brazil right now, under WTO rules, probably could attack us for our ethanol tariff, which we just extended. They can't. Their only recourse is to raise the price of the product they sell to us. You have to have leverage. There has to be something to collateralize that self-policing relationship. And we, the emitters, are unfortunately the police. And until the biggest emitters have a financial obligation to their own stakeholders, they're not going to be submitting to this kind of extranational police. You can go and win a WTO verdict. I go back to this all the time. We had an extraterritorial income tax framework that caused us to have some advantages vis-a-vis Europe. And Europe said, gosh, that's wrong, and won in WTO court in 2000 and then in 2002, and we looked very smugly at them and said, what are you going to do about it? And what they did is they said, we're going to tax you. And they started with a 5% duty in 2004 and raised it 1% a month on those exports. In October, we buckled, and we changed the law, albeit in a way that was somewhat arbitrary and capricious. But the bottom line was that we responded because they had the leverage. They were a destination market that we needed. If you're going to get that kind of policing leverage, it has to involve a trade relationship where the party who has a grievance has leverage.
Mm-hmm. I think you're seeing with Brazil, if you want to take that example, where they are exerting their leverage under the World Trade Organization and have more leverage than they would have otherwise without it. And you keep using the carbon police. There is no international carbon police. These are the reason why Brazil doesn't want to go after the United States or has not yet fully gone after them, although they've certainly made sounds, as you know, is because of larger political dynamics.
Of course. Ferrometals. But dollars work.
But why you still haven't refuted my basic international legal assertion, which is...
I agree that it works, but dollars are the agents of change here, or shekels, or whatever you want to use as your currency. The MTCO2 sub E currency unit is going to have more success at this than the diplomat wielding a law.
I think a good illustration of this, and I've been trying to get in the red topic for most of the discussion here, and we haven't talked about it yet, is probably the red situation, actually, because one of the main problems in the discussion around the red text, which was actually pretty final coming out of Copenhagen, so people were just kind of twiddling their thumbs hoping to adopt it.
And red is reducing emissions from degradation and deforestation.
Mm-hmm. So this effort to create a global incentive mechanism to save forests and have the money to do that come from industrialized countries. One of the main discussions besides the degree to which markets should be involved in this, which was what Bolivia was all against in the red discussion, was also where to create the baseline for red reduction efforts. Everybody logically wanted it at the, and I'm pointing at Bill here, wanted it at the national level, because the point is that a country takes on a commitment and tries to reverse its deforestation trajectory, and then it should get credit for the degree to which it does that. However, where is all the action right now? Pilot projects, small-scale programs that are, in some cases, invested in by the private sector for voluntary carbon credits. And you don't want to snuff that by saying you have to have a national baseline and measure your reductions only at the national level, because then you get leakage. You've got this one great project financed by some corporate entity doing some good emission reduction work and, in fact, even incorporating the local community and all kinds of great sustainability aspects. But it falls by the wayside if other parts of the country are over-emitting because they're cutting down more of their forests. So there was this whole discussion about where to set the baseline and whether it could be at a subnational level. The final text actually agreed on using subnational baselines as an interim measure, and how interim really is a question that is going to be decided later. But this captures the discussion that we're having right now, because where do you draw the line between what is the overall command and control approach of having a nation be the actual body that is responsible for this production, and trying to incorporate the private sector and some of the initiatives that are already going on the ground?
Folks have said internationally that all that has come to date has been pregame for the climate game. It's all been pregame warm up for the big game that's climate.
And everything?
Let me make my case. let me make my case.
All of it?
Because you know, we can talk about finished goods, agricultural commodities, and so on. That you can say, I'm going to take X, Y, and Z and apply a tariff to that because I believe that you have, unfair subsidies in your country for those industries. In a nutshell, that's how it works internationally. When it comes to commodities, when you're dealing with greenhouse gases, something that is so ubiquitous to everything we do in modern society, the ease of saying, well, I'm going to say you've imported X amount of this grain or Y amount of, these wonderful fuzzy bear slippers, which, by the way, I hope I get for Christmas. When you're dealing with greenhouse gases, you simply can't do it, because it's part and parcel with absolutely everything that we're doing. And how you monitor that, from the way you measure what's standing stored in the forests that have yet to be developed, how you look at it in the types of projects you finance and the goods and the technology transfer, it's much more of a challenge. And so, one thing I've heard about this is that, the problems that present in international governance and international law, comparative international law, are highly relevant to everything that's going on now with climate change. And in fact, climate change presents probably the biggest challenge that type of legal framework has ever tried to auger into. And we'll see how it goes. Now, before we wrap up the call, I want to go around just for a minute and get everybody's views on what EPA did here domestically with the best achievable control technology guidance. This, other actions that EPA is doing on the domestic front relative to emissions, is really going to be what we're going to focus on our next show. But before we go today, I'd like to get everybody's opinion on what they thought of the guidance. The one thing I'll put out there is that there wasn't all that much to chew on in that document. What were your thoughts, Kevin?
Chris, I think that, first of all, the administration got on November 2nd, I think I mentioned this before, 116 electoral college votes that voted for Obama in 2008 were behind switches from Democrat to Republican at the state level in that election, representing 33% of coal-fired greenhouse gas emissions. Now, you don't have to pretend that they get to stop everything at OMB, but they're going to think about it from this point forward. And the expectation that EPA will proceed either less rigorously or not at all I think applies to the extent that the politicals can control it. There's some things in EPA that aren't controlled by the politicals. There's consent decrees. There's going to be more of them, I suspect. And there's the folks who will release stuff even if the Obama administration can't stop it. But what the BACT said was, wow, we're not really going to do anything very aggressive. And by the way, you might want to think about biomass. We can't recommend a fuel switch, but biomass, 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 wait until January.
Bill, is, let's say, efficiency is interpreted as facility-wide, and it can reach out and potentially even, you know, touch, you know, aspects upstream of the facility itself. That's what some folks in the environmental community are arguing it should do. And let's say you have biomass done right. Is that enough? And for at this stage in your mind, for what the BACT guidance should have had in it, you know, 1,000 flowers are going to bloom through different interpretations in the states. This is all going to work its way through the courts. You know, in your mind, you know, was this enough? Was it the right amount at this point in time?
I agree with Kevin. I don't think the EPA has put its cards truly on the table. I don't think it's clear exactly how they're going to reduce carbon dioxide and other greenhouse pollutants through this rule. It's just completely unclear, and we will see starting January 2nd and in July of 2011 what actually happens. But I think it's a lot of pre-discussion leading to what actually will occur. And I want to make one point about RED, but I want to make it domestic about the United States to demonstrate sort of at this awkward pause that we're at. I can't think right now of one United States timber company that is committed for the long term certain forest management practices that will reduce carbon in a semi-permanent way. Not even the Forest Service has figured that one out, and I'm certainly not the U.S. Timber industry has figured it out. And we're not doing it with regard to land use, and to answer your question, Chris, we haven't figured out how to do it with smokestacks. And that's why my group and groups like our group are focusing on the smokestacks. You got to reduce that pollution from the smokestack, or it's all an illusion. So that's my answer right now. I think it play continues. We'll see what happens.
Are you happy that a framework's been put in place?
I am happy that a framework seems to be in place.
And that's the next step going down the road.
And I'll tell you why I'm happy a framework's in place, because the folks that are saying the end of the world as we know it will occur if EPA regulates carbon dioxide, I think those shrill cries will become just that as the process unfolds and as we realize life has gone on. This is not the end of the world as we know it, and that's a good thing.
The D.C. Circuit agreed with you.
So far, so good.
Yeah, in not staying the implementation. And it's, you know, it's fascinating. The one thing I would point out is that, you know, there are a number of folks who have availed themselves, understanding that, you know, your group has had some issues with some of the specifications on how these projects have been done. There are folks who have bound themselves at least for 100, 110 years and so on under the Climate Action Reserves protocols and such. But that debate as to how long is permanent enough for the atmosphere is certainly not going to be solved anytime soon. Lisa, from your view, internationally, was there any play down in Copenhagen on the BACT guidance? What was happening here? Was there any word that, hey, well, look, at least we're getting a framework in place, and you got to bear with us because if we made it, you know, dig in too much, then we might have, you know, pulled a stay from the D.C. Circuit right off the bat. What are your thoughts, in if at all, how it played?
Very little. There was a lot of discussion about the U.S. Being able to uphold the 17% from 2005 pledge by 2020 that it put into the Copenhagen Accord that's now been sort of officially brought into the text that's going forward. There were a lot of implicit questions in side events and in other things where the U.S. delegation actually appeared about how this target would be reached, and there wasn't much recourse for the negotiators who were answering those questions except to say, look, we've got EPA regulation that's moving forward. And then the question is always, will that EPA regulation actually achieve those 17%? And they, you know, weren't really left with much to say about that. In terms of the BACT, I don't claim to be an expert on the EPA, but as far as I understand, it has a lot to do with how states choose to implement these guidelines. And it'll be interesting to see in the context of California and the Western Climate Initiative moving forward whether that plays into any of these EPA rules and potential developments going forward.
Well, before we wrap up, one thing I'll point out, every time Kevin mentioned MERV, he wasn't talking about some odd-looking guy in the cafeteria. He was mentioning monitoring, reporting, and verification. And I do have to say that we had quite a bit of wonderful acronyms thrown around in this show, because we did get into international trade issues, currency issues, and so on. Next time, we'll be digging more into EPA's actions on the climate front, and also talk about some of the new developments that we've had in the states. California's Air Resources Board just recently finalizing their rule framework going forward. You know, what does it mean for the Western Climate Initiative? What does it mean for California? We'll get into all of that. On behalf of everyone involved in bringing you the Hot Air Show, thanks for listening. Looking forward to have you joining us next time in the heat.